I'd like to whisk you away to a colorful, magical land full of tiny inhabitants who watch over countless treasures all day long. Sorry, despite tomorrow being St. Patrick's Day, I'm not speaking of the Emerald Isle, but the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. Established in 1968 as the Margaret Woodberry Strong Museum of Fascination, the first iteration of what would become the home of both the National Toy Hall of Fame and the National Video Game Hall of Fame was based on the many collections that the museum's namesake had assembled throughout her life. But times change, and so does the curiosity of museum goers. What served the interests of one generation might be dull or stagnant for the next. I was happy to be joined by the museum's Vice President for Collections, Chris Bench, to discuss the evolution of the Strong Museum of Play. The magic and fun that visitors experience is the product of deep research and disciplined curation, one of the many aspects of museum work that has developed over the last 55 years. Back to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. I am Eric Paul, and I'm being joined today by Chris Bench, who is the Chief Curator and Vice President for Collections at the Strong Museum, the National Museum of Play, which is in Rochester, New York. And thank you for joining the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, and I'm glad this all worked out. I was just at the Strong most recently on New Year's Eve, and so this is actually one of the quickest turnarounds I've ever had for this kind of arrangement. So thanks for joining.
Sure thing. Happy to talk with you.
How are things in Rochester today? Have you gotten any of the snow? Because we just got hit here. I'm in New Hampshire, and we just got hit pretty hard with a storm, and we've got another one coming this week.
I'm waiting for snow tomorrow. It's supposed to arrive at the end of the workday tomorrow, so I'm debating whether I indeed want to go to the movies as I had planned for tomorrow night. So it may all be in flux.
I love, by the way, so I have a Rochester connection through my wife, and I love going to the movies in Rochester, especially pre-digital, before they went digital, because it was like the ultimate full circle. It's like the film that they made the movies on was made right here in Rochester, shipped out to LA. They put some stuff on it, you know, and then sent it back to us to watch. You know, I love that full circle kind of thing. So and the Strong Museum has something kind of a similar appeal to it. And so what we're going to be doing today, for those of you listening for the very first time, is the nature of this podcast is to break irregular primary sources down to see what they tell us about the time period from which they came. So historical eras. And by irregular, I mean, because the Strong Museum, as any good museum is just chock full of artifacts. It's primary sources everywhere. Every single toy, game, object in there is there because it's telling a story. But this podcast is all about looking at the non-traditional, you know, things beyond diaries and things beyond letters and photographs as documents of the past. In this case, it's going to be an actual institution, a museum, and a hall of fame or two, actually. So the first question I usually ask is about the material, but today I'm going to skip ahead to the question of the location. What is the significance of, you know, in other words, why is the Strong, why is it in Rochester? Why is it such a component to that city?
Well, that circles back to your Kodak film stock reminiscence, because the Strong Museum exists because our founder, Margaret Strong, was fortunate enough to be born the only child of wealthy parents. And her parents here in Rochester were involved in two classic industries. Her mother's family was involved in the milling industry, so milling flour, grain into flour, and her father's family was involved with buggy whips, a piece of transportation technology that we don't think much about today. But he had the foresight at the end of the 19th century, the start of the 1900s, to sell his buggy whip business. It was a good time to be getting out of that, as horseless carriages would soon take over. And with their sizable fund of money, they ran into this guy named George Eastman, who said, "I'm founding this new company called Eastman Kodak. Would you like to buy some stock?" And they basically bought in on the ground floor and had a family tradition of never selling their Kodak stock. They just let dividends accrue across ages. And the great part was that by the time that she died in 1969, Margaret Strong was the largest single stockholder in Eastman Kodak. So she had wealth and space to amass an amazing collection and to found what would be a museum that opened to the public in 1982.
So she was a collector of a lot of different toys. She was a child at heart, right? She had dollhouses. That was her big collection is it that she had for a long time.
She was perhaps best known for her tens of thousands of dolls that she had, but she was an omnivorous collector. I have to say her life was a little sad in some ways. Wealth does not always buy you happiness. She outlived her husband, she outlived her daughter, and at that point in her life she kind of went into collecting overdrive, and she could buy anything she liked. Now, whether collecting is something that you learn or it's in your genes, she may have had both, because both of her parents were collectors. Her father collected stamps and coins. Her mother collected Asian antiquities, and they traveled the world, and young Margaret was given a bag, whether they were in Tokyo or Santa Barbara, California, and she was allowed to go off with her governess and go shopping. And she had to come back to wherever the family was staying when her bag filled up. And one of the things she wrote about her collecting was that she learned that if she bought little things, she could stay out way longer because her bag didn't fill up. So she loved miniature items, part of her love of dollhouses, but she also loved dolls. She had a massive collection of doorknobs and shells and windmill items. It went on and on. Today we might put her on the show Hoarders, but at the time she was an omnivorous collector. Let's call her in the gentlest way eccentric.
Got it. I was going to say, because I think the fine line between hoarder and pack rat even is the sense of organization to it. And so it sounds like organized. In fact, when you're listing off the things that she would collect, I'm like, you're describing the contents of my household. My wife, you know, is in, and I love that word, omnivorous. I'm going to, you know, that's the best way to put it. We have, I think, I would like to say we compete with probably the strongest, largest Raggedy Ann collection in New England, maybe New Hampshire, I could put it that way. It's pretty big, and she has a dollhouse in almost at least one dollhouse in every room of the house, if not more, because it's, and it might have something to do with that, like you said, about the size of them, the miniature pieces at least, equates to not having to, you know, stop your collection short, because you can keep going with it and it's not going to accrue that much real estate. And I think so transitioning from that collection. So that's the material that the museum started with, at least was her collection.
That's right.
And then did she have it on display before it transferred into the museum in 1982? Was that something that she regularly did, is invited people to take a look at what she had?
Yes, she had people into her house all the time, and she had a guest book. And what people would write is, "What an amazing museum," or "This should be a museum." Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether she had the idea before her guests sort of planted that seed, but in 1968, she applied to the New York State Board of Regents for a charter to be a museum. And At that point, it was called the Margaret Woodbury Strong Museum of Fascination because it was the things that fascinated her.
Yeah.
And she had seen over the years that other people who saw her accumulation were also fascinated. So that's what she got the charter for. And in New York State, colleges, public broadcasting, museums all have to be chartered by the State Board of Regents who oversee education. So she visualized that, and she was very open-ended in her will. She died only a year later, so she never got to see her museum come to fruition. But as opposed to somebody like Isabella Stewart Gardner in Boston, who said, "I'm leaving you my stuff, you've got to keep it untouched ever after," Margaret Strong said, "Form a museum, form a board, decide what to do with my collection. And here, by the way, is $60 million, which in 1969 was a lot of money."
Yes, and I wouldn't turn it down now either. You know, that would be really great. So, museums are just like anything else. Those are they tell something about the time period that they're put together. I think about you mentioned the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. That one does have a theme to it, obviously, fine artwork, but a lot of museums, I feel like at the turn of the century, the early 20th century, were just kind of like museums of curiosities, kind of what she was envisioning. But not just, maybe not fascinations, but more like just, here's a two-headed snake, or here's, a bunch of gems that we found. And, because it a lot of times reflects what the public is after, what they want to see. So by the time you get to the late 1960s, I think there's a lot of people pretty fascinated with a great deal of things. That's like, we're into space. It's, we're blasting off to the moon. We're getting ready to anyway, as a society. And, people are taking in new forms of media all the time. Television was at its height in that era, new kinds of music. And so it seems just the title that she was envisioning a little bit antiquated, but it didn't take long before it really matched perfectly with the what people are after as a museum. By what point, so 1982 is when the museum that we're familiar with now, the one that you work for, came to fruition.
It was a different museum. It was okay. Not about play at that point.
Okay, so I was going to ask when that bridge was crossed. Yeah.
You set up a perfect segue, because in the 1970s, the new museum's board of trustees said, "We've got all this stuff, we've got all this money, we've got to figure out what knits it all together and what is its mission going to be other than, wow, we've got cool stuff." So they brought in five outside experts who happened to all be male and all from very traditional history museums and decorative arts museums, from Colonial Williamsburg, from the New York State Historical Association, from Old Sturbridge Village. And what those experts did was they looked around Margaret Strong's collection and said, "Wow, what great toys and games. But what you really need are more examples of antique furniture," because basically that's what their museums were all about.
Right.
And they couldn't see beyond their time and their particular lens. And they felt like this needs to be a New York State version of what our collection looks like at the Winterthur Museum in Delaware or Old Sturbridge Village in Massachusetts. So you need to reflect how everyday Americans live from 1820 to 1940, and that's what you're going to be about.
Mm.
And that was a problem, because other museums were doing a great job at that, and we sort of found ourselves in a box. And in fact, I started with the museum in 1989, and our attendance had been going down every year after the museum opened to the public, when there was a real excitement about seeing what was in this new museum, but it really wasn't clicking with anyone. It wasn't fulfilling a society's need. And it wasn't until we started becoming a hands-on museum in the late 1990s with exhibits about things like Sesame Street, that We engaged people, we engaged families, and in the early 2000s, we took a look at, gee, we've got these great toys, dolls, games. How do we merge that with our antique dishes and furniture and clothing? And we eventually concluded it was we need to forget about the dishes and the furniture and the clothing and be all about the toys, dolls, and games because that's what we're uniquely qualified to do and that nobody else is doing. And that's when we restyled ourselves as not just the Strong Museum, but as the Strong National Museum of Play.
And that's such a, thank you for that great summary and story because it sheds so much light on, I've done one other museum as a primary source for this show, and that was one I used to work at here in New Hampshire called Strawberry Bank Museum. And they went through a very similar transition around the same time, in the 70s, where they were chartered late 50s. They opened mid 60s, and they were basically going to be Colonial Williamsburg of the Northeast. And because they realized after a short while, they're like, well, the unique thing about our museum, unlike some of the other living history museums, is that we have most of the neighborhood that we're interpreting intact, and each one of those houses tells a different story. We can put them in different time periods. So instead of being just strictly colonial American history, we can go span from 1695 all the way up to 1955 on the eve of it turning into a museum. And I think that, and it makes a lot of sense when I worked there, the most popular houses that people like to visit were the 20th century ones because that's what they're familiar with. And, like one of them had a TV on and, it's like playing shows from the 50s. And that when people are like, wow, and I think that same experience happens when you go to the Strong Museum of Play because, I think, and I'm sure you hear it from visitors all the time, so much of it is that walk down memory lane of, I had that toy. I remember that one. Hey, there's my buddy. There's He-Man. There's, and seeing it presented rather than as just here's a, because I've been to toy museums before. There's one up in, like above a store in Vermont. Northern Vermont has one. And it's just like, behind glass, they're organized. There's G.I. Joe case. There's a Barbie one. There's, but it's not. I love the layout of the Strong and how you go from exhibit to hands-on to exhibit to video game to it allows you to just kind of, learn but also play, and it's just the full spectrum in every section of the museum. It's not like broken up into different parts. Is that something that you said came together sort of late 90s, early 2000s, that design?
That's what we've been continuing to evolve, and certainly for the past 20 years, we've recognized that people move through our exhibits not like reading a book or watching a movie or a TV show in a linear way. They move more like pinballs, which is coincidental because we have pinball machines as part of our collection that people can
Yes,
play.
we had a lot of fun on
So
those.
people bounce around to what attracts them and interests them, and you're right. You absolutely nail it. One of my favorite things to hear as I walk across the exhibit floor is, I had one of those from somebody who hasn't thought about that item, whether they're 8 or 88, for maybe years, and suddenly they are just powered back in time. Now, I love art museums. I am enraptured and enthused and uplifted by what I see at art museums, but very few people walk into the MFA in Boston and say, oh, it's just like the Monet that we have. And the great thing about the Strong is that you recognize yourself in the story, and this is your story, and that we start with things that are very much in the present and or near present. So we take people back in time rather than saying, creatures climbed out of the primordial ooze and then evolved and have to go a long way to see something that you resonates with you. We start with where people are today and try to take them fresh directions as grown-ups, as kids, as multi-generational groups.
It's such an important thing, and I think that that's kind of the same direction of the spirit of my podcast is the same way, that every single thing, toy, game, movie, whatever, is speaking to you, you know, and to consider these things that you have around your house, like behind glass or in a museum with a card next to it explaining it, you know, it validates people a lot. You know, they're like, oh, okay, so what I was playing with was pretty important. You know, I didn't know it, but that was part of a pretty important trend of the late 1970s where, you know, toys were transitioning to this way. And it's like that kind of, you know, immersive. And like I said, you know, it's validating, and it also, you know, reminds us that we're not just consumers all the time, you know, that we're just not just buying toys and getting them and playing with them, or it's like you're part of a larger, you know, thread of history by doing that. And that actually brings me to the Hall of Fame component of the museum,
Okay.
because I mean, I was thinking about this, just, and almost every Hall of Fame that I can think of has a museum attached to it. It's not just, you know, nobody would go to Cooperstown and be like, I just want to see the plaques. You know, I don't want to see anything else. Just, you know, no, they have a baseball museum, you know, attached to it. And each Hall of Fame that has, you know, come about is sort of a marker of the time period in which it was first conceived. It's a very, I think it's a very Western idea of having such a thing, a hall of fame, a pantheon, you know, like in Rome, where it's just like, here are the respected idea, you know, these are the things that we value, we admire, and things like that. Before I ask you the story about how it came to Rochester, I was thinking about it. I'm like, there are a lot of hall of fames in that, like, across I-90, you know, which in
You're
New
right.
York, once you hit I-90 in New York, you're on the Erie Canal. So Cooperstown, you know, probably the most famous of the Hall of Fames in the United States anywhere, is off the Erie Canal. You have the Basketball Hall of Fame, which is in Springfield, Massachusetts, which, you know, slight diversion off of I-90. You have the Boxing Hall of Fame in Canastota, New York, or right off the Erie Canal again. You go beyond New York State, and the Football Hall of Fame is in Canton, Ohio, which is not terribly far off I-90. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Cleveland, Ohio, right off of I-90. It's so it's like that corridor, and each one of them, you know, maybe not total, like the Cooperstown one, that's like, yeah, Abner Doubleday, he created baseball, let's give it to him, you know, and we'll throw that into Cooperstown. But it seems like each one of them has like a rhyme and a reason. Like the National Football Hall of Fame is there because that's where, you know, Canton, Ohio is where like the first professional game of football was played. And Springfield is where basketball was invented. So that makes sense. Why the National Toy Hall of Fame and Video Game Hall of Fame in Rochester?
Well, we don't have sort of a geographical reason the way some of those others do. And in fact, we didn't invent the National Toy Hall of Fame. That started at a little museum in Salem, Oregon, A.C. Gilbert's Discovery Village. And if the name A.C. Gilbert resonates with you, it might be because you had an A.C. Gilbert erector set or chemistry set. And I won't say it was fixed, but the Erector set got into the Hall of Fame the very first year it was inaugurated in 1997. And we sort of did a little dope slap here because we have the biggest collection of toys, dolls, and games in the world, and we got scooped. Basically, they locked in the name, the concept, before we could copyright that or trademark that. So it was a few years later, when our president ran into that Oregon Museum's president at a museum conference, and ours said to theirs, "We've always envied you your Hall of Fame." And she said, "You know, for the right price, it could be yours." Because they had been inducting toys for about 4 years, and they ran into trouble with somebody who is near and dear to your household, It was Raggedy Ann.
Oh.
And it wasn't that Raggedy Ann was a problem. It was that Raggedy Ann's fans were a problem. They were determined to get Raggedy Ann into the National Toy Hall of Fame. They sent petitions. They sent letters. They tied up the switchboard. At one point, there was even a protester dressed as Raggedy Ann out in front of the museum saying, the sign saying, let Raggedy Ann in. And Raggedy Ann did get in that year, but they were kind of exhausted by all of that. They were a little museum. This had become the tail that was wagging their dog. So when they heard that there was somebody who would take it off their hands, give them a little financial benefit for being the creator, and take it over, it was the perfect time, it was the perfect place, and we have been inducting toys ever since, every November. And it is a great boon to the Strong Museum, and I think to toys, especially as we draw attention in the holiday season to classic toys that deserve remembering, not just this year's top 10 list from Target or Amazon or Walmart. It's what deserves, what stood the test of time, what deserves remembering, what deserves celebrating. And those are the toys with icon status, with recognition factor, with longevity, and with great play value that we induct every November into the Hall of Fame.
It's a there's so much there, you know, to work with, but the Strong really seems to have, and that's such a good way of you know, pointing out, it's in November, it's on the same level now. It's not just like, you know, a little side note on the internet. It's like you see it on the same level as things like just today, you know, the Oscar nominees were announced, and when the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, announces its inductees or its nominees, you know, the Strong Museum now, it's like, you know, you see a little blurb in the newspaper, or it might be on social media somewhere, or a radio station's website, like Rochester, New York, you know, the this year's class of toys has come out. And I see the effects of that when I go into the toy aisles at stores, because those classic games, I have an 8-year-old son, so I'm not just like wandering on toy aisles, but we were just at a store today, and so much of not only the toy lines themselves, but even the packaging are tapping into the classic look, because they understand that these are the ones that have, like you said, stood the test of time, and they are completely like, it's almost like the Strong Museum seal of approval. Like, you know, the same way that if, you know, somebody were, you know, doing signatures at some kind of convention or event, if it said like, you know, Hall of Fame Slugger, you know, and, you know, Paul Molitor is going to be appearing, it has that much more, you know, seriousness to it and gravitas and stuff. So it seems that the initial idea was kind of self-serving and, you know, not really, you know, Salem, Oregon. Whereas the Strong has taken it to new places and saying, okay, this is a real thing. You know, it's not something to just kind of dismiss and say, you know, that's, you know, oh, that's kind of funny. That's, you know, no, these toys have some kind of status, that they have, you know, more than just, a few people played with them or got some kind of appreciation out of them. It's, you know, it's made it.
In an average year, we get 1.5 billion media hits for the Hall of Fame announcement. And so that's on television, radio, in print, online. It is a great way to get, as you say, to get the word out and really to tell a story about history, why these toys are important. And we also like being slightly controversial. If people argue about why did they induct the cardboard box into the Hall of Fame in 2005, I thought we were going to take heat from that when we went to Toy Fair, the big trade show that happens in New York City. But those people who spend their lives and earn their livelihoods from manufacturing and selling toys kept coming over to our booth and saying, oh, I remember when the neighbors got a side-by-side refrigerator. It was the biggest box we'd ever seen. We turned it into a castle. We turned it into a spaceship. When it got floppy, we put it on a hill and slid down the grass in the summer. It taps into all sorts of memories and interests. And if we can get the morning anchors debating on whether sand really deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, as well as American Girl dolls at risk or whatever that particular year's inductees are, we're doing our job and doing something right.
So that speaks to the behaviors and ideas component of the museum, that it's about more than just putting toys behind glass and saying, remember this, remember this, remember this. It's bringing up people's critical thinking abilities and dialogue with each other. And, you know, I run into that all the time when I've been doing it for a year, but I do a live version of my podcast where I have people select from my collection of things that I bring with me something that speaks to them. And so often it's a toy. You know, they'll pick up a toy or some other, you know, related item from their youth, and you can just see it all coming back to them. And before they know it, we've chatted for, you know, 15, 20 minutes about the significance of that thing in time, but also to them. And, you know, that's it's almost like the Hall of Fame term was just kind of utilized because that's what we call these things. But it's more than just, you know, a Hall of Fame in that it's just like, yep, these are the ones, you know, only mean something to them. Like you said, it's about getting people talking, interested, and saying, all right, well, if it's not the stick, which I love that one, that's like, yeah. And it's, you know, what else would it be? Because that's like the first toy was, you know, somebody picking up a stick. What is it? What would you say is like your number one, maybe your favorite item in the entire collection? And is that also a visitor favorite too?
One of the ones that comes to mind first is our original Monopoly board.
I love that.
One that Charles Darrow created. It was his first one that he handmade. Now, he had completely ripped off the idea. This was not his unique idea. He was basing it on a folk game that was based on an earlier manufactured game from the early part of the 20th century, a game called The Landlord's Game from a woman named Elizabeth Maggie Phillips. And that game was designed to teach you how awful it was to have a money-grubbing landlord. And you could play it collaboratively with your playing partners because she was trying to teach cooperation and sort of class solidarity and some messages like that. But she also said there was a second way to play it more competitively that she called Monopoly. And what people rapidly discovered was they loved bankrupting their family and friends. They didn't want to play cooperatively. And it was a folk version of that Monopoly game of the Landlord's Game that Charles Darrow played at a party outside of Philadelphia where he lived, and he thought this is a great idea. He adapted it to the local big new resort town of Atlantic City that was a boom town not very far from Philadelphia, and as they say, the rest is history. But the first Monopoly board is circular because the Darrow family had a round kitchen table, so it looks a little different to that degree. But other than that, right down to the typeface on the spots, the properties around the perimeter of it, it is really close to the first classic version of Monopoly that Parker Brothers brought out in 1935. Now, it took them a while to catch on. They thought, oh, this game takes too long. Nobody's going to want to play a game with money. But a little momentum got underway with the ones that Charles Darrow was personally selling, and they glommed onto it. And there, even at the peak of the Great Depression, when people were struggling to put food on the table, they were shelling out a dollar for a Monopoly set because that was days and years of entertainment ahead. And it remains perhaps the best-selling board game in American history. It's certainly one that has influenced lots of us. And it is one that it's great to have this iconic very first version of the Monopoly board as part of our collection.
And that one's cool because it's a circular board. Is that's the one you're talking about?
That's right.
The circular one. And it's like, I kind of wonder, when I was looking at that, I'm like, I wonder if this version had taken off, how different it would have been, you know, would it have maintained? Because there's something about, you know, counting 10 across each side and, you know, and I love that game because it's not only so adaptable and that there's so many versions of it. You know, I'm sure some of them are completely bootlegged. I was at, you know, in Rochester, they have a Rochester right. Monopoly that you can buy at Wegmans. And, you know, and most communities have some version of it, but also like I play with my son, a Star Wars Monopoly, and there's, you know, I'm sure there's a Harry Potter one, all the different, but also adaptable in that it has ground rules, like depending on where you're playing it. Like some people will say with Monopoly, okay, if you land directly on Go, it's $400. Or if, you know, they'll start, you know, every fee that they have to pay for community chests, they'll put it in the center of the board. And if they land on free parking, you get to collect it. Other people are like, nope, we have to stick exactly to the letter of the inside of the box cover. And I think, you know, that's one of those kinds of games because of, like you said, the time period that it caught on and was, you know, by Parker Brothers, that not only speaks to the time period of like the fantasy of like, imagine if we actually were, you know, the rich uncle, Pennybags, you know, had all this money, but, you know, we can do something with this as far as, you know, for years to come, it's going to be fun to play good, you know, family, friends, whatever, kind of items. So it's like, it is a symbol of so many other time periods. I remember Monopoly tried to go, like so many other games did, tried to go digital, like a computer version of it. And I'm like, I don't know if that doesn't work quite the same way. There's something about the little pewter pieces and the rolling of the dice, you know, clattering the board and getting the money all disorganized every time you put it away, that it's like that tangible quality of Monopoly. So I completely understand why that's such a favorite of yours. Do fans or do guests respond the same way to that one as others?
Similarly, we try to give them the backstory about it, whether that all sinks into somebody on a single visit to the Strong Museum. And there's a great book called The Monopolists about the history of that game and Lizzie Maggie Phillips' role in its creation. So it's got lots of layers to it, but yes, it is something that jumps out at people because it looks close enough to the one that they're mm-hmm. familiar with, but different enough that it attracts their attention. So it kind of stops people in their tracks a little bit.
So, you know, I don't want to harp too much on the location component of it, but like I'm a teacher most of the time, and you know, we've had like so many snow days, I forget that I'm actually a teacher. But when I was telling my students about my recent visit to Rochester, I told them about the Strong Museum of Play. And, you know, I said one of the reasons why I think it's perfectly reasonable that there's a toy museum and a National Hall of Fame there is because toys, unlike some of those other things, don't really have like a home base. They are enjoyed. It's the ultimate popular culture because they are not, you know, regional. It's not, you know, local. It may have been at one point, but, you know, like if you go to Arcola, Illinois, that's Raggedy Anvil. You know, I found that out two summers ago. We were driving cross country. We made a stop in Arcola and, you know, we missed the Raggedy Ann parade by about a week or so. So I was like, that's good.
Well, and there used to be a Raggedy Ann museum there, and when it went out of business, their whole collection came to the Strong Museum. So I was part of that transition. So you and I can do the secret Raggedy Ann and Andy handshake the next time you're at the museum.
I'll make sure to do that, and my wife will be the judge as to whether we're doing it right or not. Someone like me who sees a story about history in everything, you can imagine that touring the Strong Museum can borderline on an analytical overload. Every corner of the sprawling building in downtown Rochester features some kind of plaything, from 18th century dolls to 20th century video games and everything else in between. When considered and analyzed, each of these toys and games tells a story of the time period, place, and society for which it was made. Now, the function of a museum is to present about a subject using its artifacts, primary sources, and their interpretations as evidence to support claims. But looking at the secondary source, in this case, the Strong Museum itself, why it was made and the way it has developed over the last half a century, as a primary source, opens up in an entirely different perspective on different eras of history. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the first half of my conversation with Chris Bench of the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. If you'd like to hear the second half, go over to patreon.com/EPSpodcast, become a member, and it's yours to listen to. Same thing for EPSpodcast.substack.com. Be sure to follow the show on social media, including YouTube and especially on Instagram. Show notes and essays about history and pop culture and history can be found over at Substack. Be sure to tune in next time to the EPS podcast, where everything, including the Strong Museum of Play, the National Toy and Game Hall of Fame, and the Video Game Hall of Fame, are primary sources. We'll talk to you next time.